Good morning and welcome to the Walt Bodin Show. I'm Monroe Dodd. Walt Bodin has the day off. Lately, we've heard lots about the period a century and a half ago when the argument over slavery raged along the Missouri and Kansas border. Much has been made about the ferocity of those times, but relatively little has been written about the people who lived the daily lives of slaveholders and slaves. Slavery was legal in Missouri for decades before the Civil War and didn't end until the war decided the matter in 1865. But how was slavery practiced in Missouri, and what were things like for slaves and their owners? Our guest today, Diane Mutie Burke, has researched the topic and produced a fascinating book called On Slavery's Border, Missouri's Small Slaveholding Households, 1815-1865. Diane is an associate professor of history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She grew up in Kansas City and earned her bachelor's degrees from Dartmouth College and her master's and doctorates from Emory University. Diane, welcome to the Walt Bodin Show.
Well, thank you for having me here today.
The Civil War settled the matter of slavery in our country, and today reasonable Americans would agree that one person ought not to own another person. But in Missouri, in the early 1800s, the context was vastly different. Along the Missouri and Mississippi rivers, and certainly in our part of the state, slavery was legal and widely accepted. Set the scene for us, if you will.
Well, I think when most people think about slavery in America in the years before the Civil War, they think about large plantations, you know, gone with the wind. And in fact, that was not the way slavery was practiced here in Missouri. By and large, Missouri slaveholders owned only a few slaves. It was essentially slavery on farms. And so that's what I was wanting to look at. How was slavery different in Missouri? Was it different in Missouri? How did region affect the experience of slavery and slaveholding? And how did size of slaveholding affect that experience?
Slavery as an institution, whether you own slaves or not, in Missouri was accepted. It was part of life.
Right.
In the 1820s, the 1830s, the 1840s, if things rancor began in the 1850s.
Well, the rancor began a little bit earlier than that. There were certainly people who were starting to question slavery. They were starting to argue that it was a moral wrong, mostly, of course, in the North, although there were a few people in the South who questioned it as well. They tended to eventually get pushed out of the South. They weren't welcome there anymore when they really pushed back on this issue. So, you know, I'm, of course, talking about the abolitionists. They were kind of a fringe group early on. There were people who started to question slavery as early as the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really heat up until the 1820s and 1830s. More and more people start to talk about slavery as being a moral wrong. They talk about the immediate abolition of slaves. But it's still a fringe group. It's not until this question of whether or not to extend slavery into the new territories, in the wake of the Mexican War and all the territory that America acquired, that they really that more people start to become involved. And it's not necessarily that they're abolitionists, that they think that we should do away with slavery in the South, but they don't want slavery extended. They want to be able to go wherever they want to go without having to compete with slave labor. And so they're free soilers. And it draws more and more people into the fight against slavery at some level. So maybe they're not all the way there. They're not abolitionists, but they're certainly anti-slavery, and they're concerned about the political power of the South, and they're concerned about what happens in these new territories. And so that's how the conflict erupts in Kansas.
Today we see slavery as abhorrent in any of its guises.
Right.
But back then, as you say, there were people that didn't necessarily do it and could own slaves in their own little families. And that's
right.
The core of your book is the family, the group, the small group of Missouri with a small number of slaves, yet, and then what kind of interactions and relations they had.
It's hard to imagine that anybody thought that was okay. I mean, it's hard to get past that. And you know, I certainly struggled with that as I wrote this book, The Psychology of Slave Ownership. All I can say is that it was an institution that was practiced for hundreds of years. Certainly, many of these slaveholders, there had been slaves in their families earlier on, and it was just sort of an accepted fact of life in the American South. You know, we look at it now as being wrong, but they certainly didn't look at it that way at the time. And so I think, though, they had to figure out how to operate within the system, whether or not they were really, you know, questioning it morally. It's hard to tell. Sometimes you get some little glimmers of that, but most of the time you think that they weren't really all that troubled by the actual institution of slavery. They were more troubled by the everyday relations of life within these households. You know, we're talking about slavery on farms. Sometimes slaves actually lived within the house. Most often lived in cabins, but they were usually close proximity to the slaveholder's home. Unlike in the South, where there were these large plantation quarters that set off kind of at a distance from the big house. And so there was a lot of daily interaction because, in fact, in Missouri, slaveholders, both men and women, were very involved in the labor of the farm. You know, these farms were not large enough. They did not own enough slaves in most cases to sit around and do nothing. So they were involved in at least the management of the labor, but sometimes in the labor as well. I mean, certainly women were within the household. And men were usually out in the fields with their slaves, of course, never doing the most arduous of mm-hmm. the labor, but certainly involved in what was happening. And so there's this daily interaction that, of course, sometimes can erupt into extreme violence, sometimes can generate some feelings of some mutual feelings, certainly not friendship, but or you know, maybe not even affection, but you know, concern for one another. You know, the continuum is really long. You know, where things could fall out within these households and the relations between people.
In the Deep South, slavery was a method of getting a lot of people to do labor-intensive work, namely picking cotton. Mm-hmm. In Missouri, the crops were somewhat different. The big crops were, I guess, tobacco and hemp in a lot of cases. Cotton didn't grow well very far north
right.
Of the Missouri line. And so how did that then caused fewer slaves to be used typically?
Well, what I argue is that, yes, I think cotton is one of the keys to why there are smaller slave holdings in Missouri. It does grow here, but the growing season is not long enough for it to grow consistently, I guess I would say. So, you know, some years it can work out pretty well, some years not. And so they chose not to grow cotton. And partly what they were doing essentially is transferring their slave-owning and their agricultural culture from where they had come. And that was Virginia and Kentucky, where they mostly produced tobacco and hemp, at least in Kentucky, and, you know, historically had produced tobacco in Virginia, and then grain crops, mostly corn. They weren't growing a lot of wheat early on, although, you know, in the years before the Civil War, they certainly always raised a lot of hogs, and they did start to raise cattle and, in fact, got really involved with cattle breeding. I mean, and certainly horses and mules. You know, we've all heard of the Missouri mule. So they were raising some crops to send, actually, interestingly, to the South, to those plantations where they had become so consumed with cotton production that oftentimes on these large plantations, they weren't even producing the food that they were eating. They mm-hmm. were shipping it in from the Upper South, interestingly. So Missouri was involved in that trade. They were certainly selling tobacco, and they were producing hemp, which also contributed to the cotton economy, rope and bagging for hemp. But they were not exclusively growing those crops. It was generally diversified farming, so they would grow a variety of crops. And of course, the more slaves that you owned, the more of those cash crops you could grow. But they weren't exclusively doing that. So it's not as much the gang labor with all the slaves out in the cotton field that you think about. Mm-hmm. You know, the men were generally general farmhands, and the women were mostly working in the homes, although enslaved women were versatile as laborers in slaveholders' minds because they believed that they could send them to the fields if they needed their labor. And they did that quite often during planting and harvesting.
You're listening to The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. Walt has the day off. Today we're talking about what life was like for Missourians in the decades leading up to the Civil War, the years when slavery was legal. Our guest is Diane Mutie Burke, and her book is On Slavery's Border, published by the University of Georgia Press. Diane teaches here at UMKC. You mentioned that the migrants to Missouri, the white ones who had a chance to own slaves, were coming from the northern part of the Confederacy, well, what became the Confederacy,
right.
the northern middle states, the Virginias, the Kentuckys and places. And they didn't come here and buy slaves. They often usually brought their slaves with them.
They did. They were by and large small slaveholders in the places where they originated. They were oftentimes coming from the upland parts of those states, and they were moving west because land was cheaper. They knew the soil was more fertile. For example, tobacco is notorious for depleting, or was notorious for depleting soil during those times. Before they understood, you know, what we do about fertilizers and all that. And so they would look for new land, and they came here to Missouri looking for that, and mostly settled along the Missouri River and, well, first the Mississippi River, but then the Missouri River, really from Callaway County or Boone County westward to where we are today. And, of course, the rivers were great because they could easily ship their crops to market.
Lafayette County was not far from Kansas City. Lexington is its seat. It looked to be, according to charts in your book, maps in your book, one of the very biggest counties for slave ownership.
And Howard County was large as well.
But then also Clay and Platte counties, mm-hmm. just north of Jackson County. And Jackson County had slaves too.
Right. Oh, of course. And in fact, those areas were growing even up to the time of the Civil War. Because Platte County is not settled until later. So it's really, you know, a place of growth, Platte County, Buchanan County, you know, moving up the river.
We think of Kansas City as a sizable town today. But in those years before the Civil War, this was all pretty rural country.
It was. And Kansas City had, you know, at the time of the Civil War, had only been around for a little while. I mean, Westport had been around longer in independence. And, of course, those were big sites for people moving westward, you know, outfitting sites for that westward migration. But by and large, yes, they were agricultural areas, and it is hard to think about that today.
Your book is exceedingly thoroughly researched, and I'm envious of that, and I also appreciate it. But research on, specifically from the side of the slaves can be rather tough. Where do you go to find out their attitudes toward things?
It's very tough because historians estimate that probably only about 10% of enslaved people had any form of literacy, and that would even be just basic literacy, signing your name. So they weren't leaving the kinds of records that the slaveholders often were leaving. So I had to be a little bit creative about that. I mean, you certainly find information about slaves in white people's records, mm-hmm. And things like court records and even newspapers, more sort of traditional sources for studying history. But for finding the voices of formerly enslaved people, the best places to look are the WPA narratives, which that was part of the New Deal, the Works Progress Administration. It was called the Federal Writers Project. And what they did is they put to work a bunch of out-of-work journalists, mm-hmm. and academics, and they sent them – and, you know, writers of various kinds. They sent them throughout the country, really, collecting narratives of people's lives in the past. And it wasn't just that they were looking at slavery. They also were trying to collect a lot of folklore. They were all over the Ozarks, for example, in the Appalachian Mountains. But they were just collecting information, and they collected all of these narratives of people who had experienced slavery. So, of course, it's the 1930s. They're fairly old at this point. They're most likely remembering their experiences of slavery during their childhood, or maybe remembering or telling stories that their parents had told them. So you have to filter through that memory aspect to try to figure out you know, what exactly happened. You know, there were some of the interviewers were African-Americans. Some of them were white. And so you have to think about that. I mean, it's tricky evidence to work with, but I feel like, you know, we need to include it because it's one of the few times where we actually can hear people tell us what their experience was during slavery. So there are a little over 100 of them from Missouri. So that was a very important source. There are also five really important escaped slave narratives. So stories or, you know, books that people wrote after they had escaped slavery, or in the case of a couple of them, they were basically biographies that they wrote after the Civil War about their experiences during slavery. One of the most famous is William Wells Brown, who it was one of the most famous abolitionists of his time. And he had been enslaved in St. Louis, and he has, you know, amazing story of his experience in slavery. He was hired out to a number of different people, including Elijah Lovejoy, who was a newspaper editor in St. Louis, who was an abolitionist who was martyred, basically, for the abolition cause. Mm-hmm. And he also worked for a slave trader. So he gives us a lot of information about the domestic slave trade, the trade down to New Orleans, because he's literally on a steamboat with this man taking slaves south. And then another really great one is by a man named Henry Bruce, who's from Sheridan County. And he is writing his narrative in the 1890s. He's the brother of Blanche Bruce, who was one of the two black senators from the South during Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. They were both enslaved here in Missouri, and they were both literate during slavery. And he tells – he just gives tremendous details about his experience of slavery in Missouri, and then also about his life after slavery. Bruce ends up working in Washington, D.C., and government jobs, basically, in the years after.
We already have a caller, Joe Lewis in Kansas City. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. My question is, were there any laws or pertaining to the treatment, the sale of slaves, and also, as you mentioned, that, you know, the slaves lived sometime close by, maybe in the house or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What was the, the position of the church, Catholic Church, Protestant Church, and especially the Mormon Church during this time?
Okay, those are a couple of really good questions. Well, the law really favored the slaveholders by and large. I mean, it was illegal to kill your slave, for example, but we know that it happened sometimes. People essentially sometimes got away with murder. So, you know, there was certainly an expectation that that you would not treat your slaves too severely. But again, oftentimes it happened, and there would be maybe some community sanction for that kind of activity, but there's quite a bit of evidence that oftentimes those people were eventually sort of brought back into the community after this has happened. Although not always. Some people went on the run after they committed some kind of really, really heinous crime against slaves. As far as the churches were concerned, that's a really interesting question. Certainly there were a lot of slaveholders that were members of the Protestant churches here in Missouri, mostly Baptist and Methodist, Presbyterian, and there were also enslaved members of those churches. It was the churches were not segregated in the years before the Civil War, and I've seen some records in church records, which are incredibly interesting, because what would happen in the years before, well, really in the 19th century, is that the church would convene basically a trial if a member committed some kind of, crime isn't necessarily the right word, but some sort of infraction, which could range from drinking or not attending the Sabbath to mistreatment of slaves. Or, you know, I saw one case where they sanctioned a member because he had sold his slave man south. And I suspect that that man was probably a member of the church as well, which is why they got involved in it. But by and large, the church was not getting involved in those kinds of activities that were happening within people's homes. The Catholic Church did try to be a little bit more supportive of families, for example. I mean, they were baptizing slaves within the church and sometimes recognizing marriages. But again, you know, oftentimes what's on the books and what people actually do does not match up. And the Mormons are another case altogether because they were, by and large, anti-slavery. They were reaching out to slaves in this region, and a lot of historians think that that's one of the main reasons why they were pushed out of Missouri.
Oh, can I ask one more question, maybe?
Sure.
And that is when we talk about the church, and we also know that in all parts of the country, including Jackson County, there were a number of mulatto slaves, mm-hmm. in which it would indicate that there was some type of sexual relationship between slaves and slave owners. And the church didn't condemn that or just say that that was the slave owner's own business.
Well, you know, I have never seen any instance in those church records of them condemning that. I think that what tended to happen is that people sort of looked the other way. They knew that it was happening, and they didn't want to recognize it. Sometimes even the white women living within the homes didn't want to recognize that it was happening. I argue that it probably that a slave woman was probably more likely to be abused by her owner on small slave holdings just because of the numbers involved. If there are two women on a farm as opposed to 20 women on a plantation, you know, her chance of being the target of this abuse was greater. And in fact, if you try to quantify the slave narratives, for example, the cases where people mention that they were of mixed race heritage, the numbers go up on the smaller the slaveholding. So there is some quantitative evidence to back that up.
Well, thank you for your important research.
Well, thank you for calling in.
Thanks, Joe Lewis. Bob and Lawrence sends us an email, and you've mentioned the oral histories made in the WPA project of the 1930s. Were there other slave narratives? Did you use songs? What other resources did you have? You mentioned pension funds, I think.
Pension claims, yes. So certainly the WPA narratives and the escape slave narratives, which were essentially abolitionist literature. They were oftentimes, at least the ones before the Civil War, were written to try to convince people that slavery was wrong, like William Wells Brown's narrative. But I also used pension records, and those were incredibly useful for trying to find information about enslaved families and communities. So what those were pension claims of family members, so mothers, wives, children of African American Union soldiers. And men enlisted in great numbers here in Missouri, enslaved men, to fight for the Union. And so many of them died. The death rates were extremely high for all Civil War soldiers, but were even higher for African-American soldiers because of the type of duty that they were doing. A lot of the Missouri men were sent down to Louisiana, for example, and were mostly dying from disease is what happened, although, of course, some died in battle as well. And so after the war, their widows and orphans primarily would file claims to try to obtain a pension, a little bit of money every month to help them get by. And so they had to present the case that the man that they were filing the claim for was actually their husband, and slave marriages were not legal, so there was no legal record of their marriage. Mm-hmm. So they would get depositions from family members and friends and ministers and sometimes former owners who would help with these claims. They also had to prove that their children were the legitimate children of the man in question, and so they would bring in sisters and mothers and doctors sometimes and mistresses to testify as to the birth of the children, because after they were 16, you couldn't get any money for them anymore. Mm. So there is just an amazing amount of material about what these communities and families were like and connections between people. You can kind of trace that out. It was really, really fascinating. And they have not widely been used to study slavery. although more people are starting to find that there are such wonderful, rich records.
I know that can be difficult terrain, and when we come back, I'd like to talk to you some more about how you figure out what's the truth and what's not in all of this. And then we'll continue our talk with Diane Mudy Burke about family life in Missouri in the days of slavery for slaves and slave owners alike. You can join us after the break by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or by emailing us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. You're listening to The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR. And welcome back to The Walt Bodine Show. Walt has the day off. I'm his co-host, Monroe Dodd. We're talking today with Diane Mudy Burke, an assistant professor of history here at UMKC, about her new book on slavery's border, Missouri's Small Slaveholding Households, 1815 to 1865. Diane will discuss her book Wednesday evening, February 22nd, at the National Archives near Union Station in Kansas City. A reception begins there at 6 p.m., and the presentation will be at 6:30. The event is free, and you can reserve a spot by calling 816-268-8010. Right now, Diane is here in the studio with me. You can join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888 or by emailing us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. And Diane, just before the break, we were talking about what it's like to read all this material done by slaves and done by slaveholders, figuring that in each instance they had something they wanted to prove. How do you sort through and find the facts?
Well, it's really tricky. You have to think about all the potential for various kinds of bias in all of this evidence. So, for example, you know, I mentioned a little bit about the WPA narratives. You know, how might an interview be different with a white interviewer or an African-American interviewer, you know, in the 1930s? So you have to think about that. You know, how might a person's memories be different than what had actually happened at the time? You have to think about, with the pension claims, the fact that, you know, people are trying to obtain a pension. They want money. They want this monthly check. And so they're going to try to prove that the relationship was solid with the man in question. The women are. They want to prove that the children are his. Some of the most interesting claims are actually disputed claims, where occasionally two different women are trying to file a claim for the same man, or a mother and a wife are trying to file a claim. And because of the way that slavery operated in Missouri, it was possible that this kind of thing could happen. There were most of the marriages in Missouri were what were called abroad marriages, so like going abroad. And what those were marriages between men and women who lived on different slave holdings. Because of the demographics of slavery, it was not possible in many cases to find a potential partner on your own slave holding, your own farm. And so they look for people other places, sometimes on a neighbor's farm, sometimes actually quite a few miles away, someone maybe that they met at church or at some kind of local gathering. And because these relationships, the men and women were apart for most of the week, by custom, usually the men would come to visit their families on Saturday night and not return until sometimes the wee hours of the morning on Monday morning to be back for work. Sometimes they were allowed to come once more during the week, but they didn't see their families that often, and so there was this physical separation that sometimes, it appears, in some cases, allowed men to have relationships with more than one woman. But what it looks like to me more often is that it was a marriage, essentially, or partnership that ended, and then, you know, he moved on to someone else that maybe oftentimes lived closer to him. And so both of these women will file a claim for his pension, because in some cases they may both have children by the same man. So then, you know, I have to try to figure out, well, what really happened here, as did the pension office have to try to figure out what happened. But in all these cases, you know, even with the slaveholders' records, which have their own kind of bias, you have to just read a vast variety of different kinds of records, records from different people, and try to filter through and figure out what you think the story is.
Let's go to Mike now. Mike, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, this is Mike from Macon County. My family had slaves in Sheridan County at the time of the Civil War. My question is, when were the slaves in Missouri, a border state, emancipated? What date? And was there any documentation to the freedom of those slaves?
That is a very, very interesting question in a place like Missouri. Of course, you know, from very early on in the war, Missouri was essentially occupied by Union troops. And Missouri had chosen in their secession convention to stay within the Union, but there were certain elements within the state who wanted to try to take Missouri out of the Union. And so ultimately this, you know, this colossal conflict emerged in Missouri that I think a lot of people are familiar with, the guerrilla warfare and all the rest. And because there was so much conflict and things were so violent here, and because the Union Army had essentially, especially in the large slaveholding counties, had planted troops in most of the county seats to try to sort of maintain the population, slaves saw the possibility, I think, of their freedom. And so what starts to happen early on, as early as the summer of 1861, enslaved people start to run to these Union troops. They understand, I argue, what the war meant way before a lot of Americans understood that it was a war to end slavery. And they recognized that these Union troops might help them achieve their freedom. Now, at first, the Army doesn't know what to do with them. They don't know if it's legal for them to keep them or not. And there's, of course, a series of federal laws that are passed about that called the Confiscation Acts, where they have to determine whether or not the slave was used in some kind of Confederate military effort, which, of course, is a little bit difficult in Missouri since there aren't, after 1861, really, true Confederate troops here. But eventually they can prove that if they're just owned by somebody who's disloyal to the Union, that they can keep them and, in fact, eventually free them. So you start to see some military records where – you know, the provost marshal in Missouri is in some places is issuing papers that declare a person's freedom. But actually, slaves were not officially emancipated in Missouri until January of 1865. So before the 13th Amendment, the Republican-led controlled, essentially, because they had disenfranchised disloyal people. At this point, they hold a constitutional convention to write a new constitution for the state of Missouri, and they free Missouri slaves at that point. But I argue that many people had basically achieved their own freedom way before that, and sometimes with the aid of the Union Army, sometimes with the aid of people in free states, you know, surrounding Missouri, because people were leaving as well. It's a very, very fascinating story.
So slavery, instead of coming to a resounding end, actually just sort of the institution wasted away.
It kind of did. I mean, that's not to say that there weren't people who were still enslaved at the point that they were freed. But so many Missouri slave men had joined the Union Army by that point or had left the state looking for work elsewhere. There were probably about 8,000 men that we know served in regiments that were recruited in Missouri, but we think many more served in regiments from Kansas, you know, like the First Kansas or Iowa or Illinois. So it's hard to account for all of them, but many, many served out of the 115,000 slaves that lived in Missouri. And many of their wives and children had fled slavery as well by that point.
You're right. And you've mentioned this morning, Diane, about the proximity in Missouri, especially, of slaves to the slaveholders, sometimes working in the same fields, sometimes living in the same house. Your book talks about involvement in child rearing and health care and other things. This gave them a certain advantage, you write, that I find fascinating. They were able to know more about the slaveholders' weaknesses and their problems and their trials and tribulations, and this knowledge helped them navigate life as slaves.
Sometimes it did. There could be some advantages for slaves in these small slaveholding households because of this intimacy that we talked about. They did know a lot about their owners. And in fact, I mean, it was always in the best interest of all enslaved people to study their owners, to try to understand at which points they could push them and try to understand where they, you know, they couldn't go too far or really bad things would happen. But in these intimate households that we're talking about, I mean, they had a lot of time to study the people who own them. And so they did figure out ways to manipulate the situation, I think. You know, one really excellent example is this woman named Paulina Stratton, whose diary I have worked with very intensely. I've, in fact, have edited it and annotated it with the hopes of publishing it sometime very soon. And she's a fascinating woman. She comes from Western Virginia to Missouri in 1855 with her husband and her children and 11 slaves, including a couple of slave women. And basically what happens within this household is that the slave women have figured out the relations within the household. Paulina has had a really difficult time with various family members over the years, at first with a mother-in-law when she lives in Virginia, who actually owns the house in which they own the farm. And so there becomes a conflict, this sort of age-old conflict between the mother-in-law and the daughter. But, you know, it's exacerbated in this case because they're literally struggling over who is controlling this household. And what ends up happening is that the slave women in the household figure this out. They know the women don't like each other, and they start to try to play one off of the other in this really, really fascinating way where – now, of course, it's all from Paulina's perspective. She's telling the story. It's her diary, but she says that, you know, they tell stories on her to her mother-in-law. They go to the mother-in-law if they want something, and she won't give it to them. They go to the mother-in-law who might give it to them. I mean, they learn how to manipulate the situation. And eventually, and I guess the other thing I should say is that, you know, Paulina claims her husband does not really support her in her struggles with her mother-in-law. And so eventually it just undermines the authority, Paulina's authority within this household. So even after the mother-in-law dies and they move to Missouri, she never is able to really get the upper hand in her own mind. They're always pushing back at her. Now, you know, of course, it would be really interesting to hear the perspective of the women who were working for her. Mm-hmm. But you know, nonetheless, it's I think it's a really interesting story, and I see similar stories, maybe not quite as dramatically spelled out as that one was, where this happens, where you know a slave woman tells the master who's been away fighting the Civil War that his wife's having an affair with a neighbor, and you know, various stories like that to sort of get back at people or to try to figure out you know, how to negotiate their situation. Now, of course, the flip side of this is that there can be, you know, tremendously rancorous relationships between people within these households. And because they are living and working so closely together, the situation can just erupt into horrible scenes of violent confrontation as well. And certainly a lot of people suffered quite a bit of abuse. So, you know, again, there's this continuum between what can be, you know, moments where there's some commonality, where, you know, women are concerned about other women and childbirth, for example, or the sickness of people, or, you know, the possibility of slaves manipulating the situation to their own advantage, and then these really horrible effects of slavery, you know, violence and abuse and, you know, the sexual abuse that we talked about, I mean, all the rest.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR. Walt has the day off. I'm Monroe Dodd, and today we're talking about life in Missouri in the days of slavery. Our guest is Diane Mutie Burke. Join us with your comments or questions at 816-235-2888 or email us at waltbodineshow@kcur.org. And we'll go to the phones now and to Imani. Did I pronounce that correctly, in Kansas City?
Yes, it's Imani, yes.
Go ahead.
I met a teacher here in the Kansas City, Missouri School District who told me about a book that her great-great-grandfather had written that she subsequently published. I think you did mention that individual's name. The name of the book was called 40 Years Free, 40 Years a Slave.
Yes.
And he recounts in that book how the terrain in Missouri is very rocky, and there was a high turnover with the slaves because they were used to work and break up that rock and literally being used as sort of like human jackhammers because their tendons would start to pull away from the joints from breaking up that rock. And even though the slave holdings were small, there was a high turnover because they were literally wearing these people out by breaking up the rock. She also recounts of a female ancestor that she had who was a slave who the master of the house had children by her to increase his slave holdings and also had children by those children.
Well, yes, certainly those kinds of things happened here. You know, like I said, oftentimes they're somewhat hidden in the records, and I think sometimes people's memories of it are the only places that you see them, although you can look at things like census records and see, because they had to, or they were asked to basically classify people by their color, and so you can kind of see a little bit about, you know, where there might be these different relationships. But certainly, you know, coming to a frontier area and trying to open up land for cultivation was really, really arduous work. I mean, not only, you know, clearing rocks, but clearing trees, because they didn't understand, at least initially, that actually maybe the prairie land was a good place to cultivate. They thought that the more fertile land was the land where the trees were. And so they would cut down these trees, and then, of course, you'd have to remove stumps. They were draining sometimes, you know, swampy type land, and all the time putting workers, which in many cases were slaves, into, you know, pretty precarious situations where they're, you know, bringing down trees or breaking up rocks or, you know, working around land that might not be very healthy. So, you know, not to say that white men didn't do this kind of work too sometimes, because certainly not all Missouri settlers owned slaves, and some were doing this work themselves. But it seems that these slaveholders were oftentimes putting their slaves into situations that they didn't want to be in themselves. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that I think for a lot of the women, they don't want to recount the fact that not only are they having children by the master of the house, who also has a wife,
right,
but that master is also having children by the children that they had to get, which, you know, it's a source of a great amount of shame for them. Thanks
well,
so much.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, yes, of course. I mean, there are all these levels of silence in this situation, I think, you know, on both sides of things. Certainly, the white women who were living in these households didn't really want to talk about what was occurring, and oftentimes enslaved women didn't either. Although you do see glimmers of it here and there, especially in the slave narratives, where they will talk about oftentimes the experiences of their mothers, not themselves.
This may be a bit far afield because it's over in Kansas or Kansas Territory, but Tom emailed us a photo at the Walt Boudin Show and wrote, "I have an old picture that's from an old family farm showing the farm owner, his wife, and three slaves. I assume they're slaves. I've always questioned this, as the farm would have been in the Hiawatha-Sabetha, Kansas area up in northeast Kansas. Was cotton grown that far north? Were there slaves in Kansas? Or would the men in the picture be free men?"
Well, it depends on when the picture was taken. But if it was taken before the Civil War, they very well could have been slaves, because there were slaves in Kansas. And even though the census does not show that there were a great number of them, there is a friend of mine named Kristen Epps who is wrote a dissertation, which she hopefully will be publishing here fairly soon, about slavery in Kansas. And she has found through other kinds of records besides the census that there were quite a few more people than she imagined, or than most people have imagined. So, you know, by and large, they were Missouri slaveholders who were moving over to Kansas trying to populate the state in order to bring it into the Union as a slave state. Although there were some people from other parts of the South that were moving there as well. And I would say that the slave holdings would look very similar to the ones here in Missouri. They were, by and large, small slave holdings.
We know Thomas Johnson, from whom the Reverend, yes, for whom Johnson County is named, had slaves.
He sure did.
He operated on both sides of the state line pretty easily.
And he was there even before Kansas became a territory. He had gotten permission, you know, basically a license, essentially, from the federal government to go set up that Indian mission. And yes, he did have slaves.
Charles writes by emailing us, "In researching my genealogy, I've discovered past family members who were slave owners in southeast Missouri. This discovery came through mid-19th century U.S. census records, which only indicate the sex and the age of a slave. Are there any additional public records that might provide some detailed information about the slaves who lived with my ancestors?"
Well, that's the hard part. It is difficult to get much more information in the census. There, in 1850 and 1860, there were actual slave censuses that were separate from the free people censuses, and they would record the age and the sex, and like I said, sometimes the color of the person, but not much more. Not their names. Tragically, it would be wonderful if we knew their names. Sometimes you can find additional records additional information in tax records, but you know, it would be similar types of information. So I think you know, I'm certainly no expert on African American genealogy, but I think oftentimes, you know, if a person is fortunate, they will find information in the slaveholder's family papers that will give more information about names. And then records like these pension records that I'm talking about. If you're fortunate enough to find a record that mentions, because oftentimes they will tell who owned them, or you know, military records when they enlisted, for example, will tell who owned them. If they're telling the truth about that, sometimes they're not. But sometimes you can trace it back that way. But it is pretty tricky business to try to find this information.
Earlier in our conversation today, Diane, you mentioned that you used the word creativity in research, and that doesn't mean creatively making up
right.
the results, but you kind of have to sit back and say, now, what have I not thought about?
Right. No, you do. And you have to look at a vast variety of records to try to get at the story.
Slave holding could be lucrative for people, not only in the production of goods and the movement of goods, but also slaves were often hired out and occasionally sold for cash, too, in Missouri.
Yes, they certainly were. Hiring is a really interesting part of the story in Missouri. I mean, this happened everywhere, but it happened all the time in Missouri, where a slaveholder who had more slaves than he would be able to really employ on his farm would hire them to other non-slaveholders and sometimes slaveholders to work sometimes for a few days. Sometimes for a month. Sometimes they would hire them for the entire year. And this was really a way for non-slaveholders to essentially enter into slavery on the cheap, because you could hire people. You could hire women or girls for, you know, way less than $100. You could hire a man who would work in the field for $150 to $200, whereas a slave would cost, you know, 10 times that in some cases. So it was a way for many more people to become involved in slavery, and sort of extends the reach of slavery in a way that I think that people don't often think about. And one of the kind of the saddest things that I saw with as far as hiring was concerned was that they were very often hiring out, you know, basically kind of young teenage girls to go, hiring them away from their parents to go work as domestic laborers in white people's homes. Oftentimes, you know, the local minister or doctor or merchant that lived in town, and sometimes boys as well to go work on farms or to work in the local, tobacco factory like Henry Bruce did when he was a young boy.
Now, this summer, Diane, you'll be teaching a workshop sponsored by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Tell us some about
yes,
that.
Yes, I will. It's very exciting. This is the third time that my colleagues and I have done this. We won a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to lead what's called a Landmarks of American History and Culture workshop. And ours is called Crossroads of Conflict, Contested Visions of Freedom, and the Missouri-Kansas Border Wars. So it's really about the Civil War era history of this region. And teachers come from throughout the nation, K through 12 teachers, to learn about this region during the Civil War. We visit a lot of local historic sites, and scholars come to talk. And I, you know, encourage any teachers out there, if you know teachers, to apply. You can check out our website at umkc.edu. NEH Border Wars. The deadline's March 1st.
Not long from now. Good luck with all of that. And you'll be talking Wednesday night at the National Archives.
Yes.
Diane Mudie Burke has been our guest today. She's the author of On Slavery's Border, Missouri's Small Slaveholding Households, 1815 to 1865. You'll find our show's archives on our website. Visit kcur.org. Our show was produced today by Andrea Salenzi. Our announcer was Kim Noble. Walt took the day off. I'm Monroe Dodd, and I'll be back in 3 weeks for another history show. And everybody out there, enjoy your day.